The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off with a little holiday stuff, since we're getting close to the Christmas and holiday season. How about the Department of Wit? How to write an unforgettable holiday letter. And don't you just love getting those things? Nothing tells family and friends you're thinking of them more than a form letter. But how to begin? Don't fret. Writing the annual holiday missive isn't difficult. To help you get started, we've jotted out a few simple rules to guide you alongside an annotated version of the letter we're sending out this year. Dear Louise, it's that holiday time of year already. Number one, my gosh, where does the time go? So much has happened over the past year, and we're eager to bring you up to speed. And these are the rules. One, people are busy during the holidays, so just in case anyone has forgotten what time of the year it is, be sure you remind them. Number two, these are 12 simple rules. Number two, begin your letter on a positive note. It's tempting to dwell on the bad, but remember, 'tis the season to be jolly. Turn frowny news into smiley faces. First, some good news. Todd found a furnished studio apartment on the Hudson River. It's in an exclusive gated community called Sing Sing, and he shares it with his new roommate, Beelzebub. The lodges come with free meals and the use of an exercise yard the guys share with 1,700 other like-minded gentlemen. Now the sad news. Todd announced that he won't be joining us for the holidays this year. Don and I will keep a place for him in our hearts. The same goes for my sainted Aunt May, who passed away in February. She lived life to the fullest, always bustling about. I'll never forget her last words. Of course, we can make the light. Number three, do share exciting news. This summer we ticked visiting Yellowstone off our bucket list. I won't bore you with the details because there's not much to say about a place that sits atop a volcanic hot spot. Features dramatic canyons, alpine rivers, lush forests, hot springs, a zillion wild animals, and gushing geysers. Other than the fact that we came home with a bison. Four, don't brag. Not everyone is fortunate as you. And number five, not sure what to discuss. Is there a new addition to the household? Maybe a pet, a plant, some kinky new mailing list labels. We hadn't intended on taking the bison home with us, but I took one look at those baby brown eyes and I knew I just had to have him. Don agreed. In fact, the only one not on board with this whole idea was the bison's mother, who headbutted Don when he got too close. But ever since Don got that metal plate in his head after being beaned by the company's softball game, he's tough as nails and about as smart. Just kidding, honey. Number six, teasing your spouse lest everyone knows that you haven't followed through on your plans to leave him. So, while Don kept Mama Bison busy, I scooped up her baby and dropped him in my purse. You know, the giant Louis Vuitton knockoff I keep all my change in. But honestly, who carries change anymore? So I had plenty of room for Ficus, which is what we named him. I know what you're thinking. Taking care of a bison is a lot of work. But Don and I are empty nesters now that Todd having moved out, and I'm confident we can handle it. Number seven, mention all your kids. We held our daughter Debbie's gender reveal party in our backyard. It was so much fun. There were presents and cake and lots of laughs. And then came the big of real. As Debbie's husband, Desmond, and their significant others, even if the ones you don't like, lit the smoke bomb, some of us shouted hopefully, pink, pink. Others shouted blue, blue. In fact, it was orange. That's because the smoke bomb ignited the bushes on our property, which spread to our house, burning it down along with everything inside it. I won't bore you with the details. But as Don ran inside to save Ficus, he just loved Todd's old room, the roof collapsed. Other than a big dent in Don's head where the plate is, he and Ficus are fine. There's a simple explanation of why that bonehead Desmond overstuffed the smoke bomb. Debbie was pregnant with septuplets. Nine, try to throw in a surprise to liven up your letter. Isn't that fun? Anywho, what with all the festivities, the spicy chicken wings, and the fire trucks, I guess the excitement got to Debbie because she plopped down and had all seven right there on our lawn. Pink, pink, blue, pink, blue, pink, blue, pink. Number 10. End on an alphabet on an upbeat note. Give the letter's recipients reason to be glad you finished reading your letter. What else? What else? Other than May being run over by a truck, Todd being incarcerated, the Yellowstone vacay and our adopting a bison, the house burning down and our daughter having septuplets on our front lawn, not much has happened. Oh, I just got a text from Todd. He and Beelzebub have escaped and they'll be joining us for the holidays after all. Number 11. As with the beginning, in the reminding everyone what time of year it is in case they've fallen asleep halfway through and forgot. And number 12, form letters could seem a bit cold, so I had a personal touch with a handwritten note addressed to the recipient. This promises to be the best Christmas ever. Gotta run and kick ficus out of Todd's tent. May you have the merriest Christmas ever, and may the new year bless you with love and happiness. Don and Jean Ficus. And Ficus. Dear Louise, where's the $20 you owe for Debbie's baby shower gift? Cough it up now. And with that holiday first start off, let's go ahead and go back to some regular stuff from the Reader's Digest. Health. Dementia breakthroughs. After decades of disappointments, new treatments and tests are finally here. 8 years ago, neurologist Dan Gibbs was sitting in a room with 24 doctors and researchers. He was getting ready to look at brain scans, not a patient's, but his own. They would definitively answer a question he's had for years. What was wrong with him? It started when he was 55 and working in Portland, Oregon. He noticed he couldn't smell certain things, like flowers. Then he began to smell things that weren't there, like perfume, citrus, or baking bread. He rapidly got a clue as to what might be the cause after doing an in-home DNA test to find out more about his family tree. The results showed he had two copies of a gene, APOE4, that increases the risk of developing Alzheimer's. He was shocked. Before his genetic test, it had never occurred to him that he might get the disease. At the time, he had no memory symptoms, but over the next few years, he noticed some mild memory problems like forgetting his colleagues' names and having difficulty memorizing his new office phone number. That combined with his background as a researcher led him to participate in a study at the University of California, San Francisco, that was focused on diagnosing Alzheimer's. And now the results were in. The researchers pulled up the pictures and showed him a beta amyloid plaques at different parts of his brain. Excuse me, the pages are stuck together. Including his prefrontal cortex and the olfactory area, which controls smell. It was a sign of early-stage Alzheimer's. Surprisingly, Dr. Gibbs was happy. When they showed me the scans, it was a relief to have a firm diagnosis, he says. What is dementia? Dementia is an umbrella term for a group of symptoms contributing to decline in memory, thinking, reasoning, and social abilities. It's progressive, and some people with dementia will need around-the-clock help at the end of their lives. 55 million people around the world have dementia, including 5.8 million in the United States. While only 1% of those ages 65 to 69 have it, the risk of being diagnosed doubles every 5 years between 65 and 84. One in four people over the age 85 have dementia. But breakthroughs in treatment and testing this year have given new hope to researchers like Don Weaver, a clinical neurologist and a director of senior scientists at the Kimball Research Institute at the University Health Network in Toronto. There's genuine room for optimism, he says. The research is moving at a faster pace than ever before. That has come to fruition with new treatments, plus groundbreaking tests in the pipeline and more to come. There are about a dozen different causes of dementia. The most common is Alzheimer's disease, which account for 67% of dementia cases. While the cause of Alzheimer's is not yet fully understood, researchers have been focusing on the malfunctioning of two specific brain proteins. The first, beta amyloid proteins, are a normal part of the central nervous system and are usually cleared out of the brain. In a brain with Alzheimer's, however, these proteins are not properly cleared away. The protein clumps together in between neurons, creating deposits called amyloid plaques, which disrupt cell function. The second type, tau proteins, that's T-A-U, are primarily found inside neurons. In people with Alzheimer's, this protein, which normally assists in the transportation of nutrients throughout the brain, accumulates and becomes tangled inside the neuron. The buildup of these two proteins affects the ability of the brain cells to communicate. Eventually, they kill the cells, affecting a person's ability to think and remember. Other types of dementia include Lewy body dementia, where protein deposits called Lewy bodies build up in the brain, affecting thinking, memory, and movement. Vascular dementia, which can happen after a stroke or blood vessel damages, reduces the flow of blood and oxygen to the brain. My father had that. And frontotemporal dementia, when the frontal and temporal lobes of the brain shrink. This line kind can happen to people as young as 40. Actor Bruce Willis was recently diagnosed with it at age 67. new drugs for Alzheimer's. For decades, the treatment of dementia can seem frustratingly dormant. Two classes of drugs that were introduced 3 decades ago can improve symptoms. Cholinesterase inhibitors boost acetylcholine, a chemical and a brain need for alertness, memory, and judgment. And memantine regulates glutamate, a chemical messenger needed for learning and memory. But neither offers a way to limit the disease progress. Aducanumab, launched 2 years ago, can reduce the buildup of amyloid plaques in the brains of Alzheimer patients, but has not been proved to show cognitive decline, to slow cognitive decline. Now, thanks to years of research progress, we're on the brink of major advances in treatment and prevention. The new drugs are big, exciting breakthroughs, says Gil Livingston, a professor of psychiatry of older people at the University College London. However, she adds, it's still early. In January of this year, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the first drug that shows the progress of Alzheimer's rather than just treating the symptoms. In clinical trials, people with Alzheimer's who took the drug lecanemab, that's also known as Leqembi, for 18 months showed their rate of memory and cognitive decline was 27% less than those in who took a placebo. But it's not clear with what that decline translates into real world. And there are downsides to the drug as given by IV. It's very expensive and can have serious side effects, including bleeding in the brain. The second drug, donanemab, not yet approved by the FDA, has also shown promise in clinical trials. Why can't they think of simple names for these drugs? It slows the rate of cognitive decline from Alzheimer's by about 1/3, but like lecanemab, it may have similar side effects. We're not quite there, says Dr. Livingston, but it's fantastic that we're beginning to be there. Big leap forwards in prevention. In the past few years, our knowledge about preventing dementia has increased dramatically. We've learned that many issues that cause dementia are treatable. We finally sorted out what the risk factors are, and we're paying attention to them, said Dr. Weaver. According to the 2020 Lancet report led by Dr. Livingston, 40% of dementia cases could be avoided. The number one factor was hearing loss, which can affect your ability to talk to other people and can lead to isolation. That really surprised us, says Dr. Livingston, and it's a reversible risk because you can change it by using hearing aids. Spending time socializing was another important lifestyle factor. Talking to other people stimulates your brain and gets it working because you have to engage, you have to think, Dr. Livingston explains. Getting 150 minutes of exercise a week can help your heart keep your heart in good shape, which translates into a healthier brain. Having a stimulating job also helps, as does having more education earlier in life. It boosts what's known as your cognitive reserve. So even if you do suffer from a loss of cognitive power, you still have some to spare. Treating depression is also important. Then there are things to avoid. Smoking and air pollution raise the risk of developing dementia. It's now known that traumatic brain injury increases the risk, as does heavy drinking, having high blood pressure or diabetes, and being obese. We know now that for many people, dementia is not inevitable, says Dr. Livingston. Blood tests for a more accurate diagnosis. Just as important as the new medications are breakthroughs in diagnosis, multiple blood tests for Alzheimer's, which have been used widely in clinical trials, are expected to be available for the public before the end of 2023, which is pretty close. According to Gil Rabinovici, a neurologist and a director of the University of California, San Francisco's Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. Currently, Alzheimer's is diagnosed by doctors through a combination of means, including physical exams, brain imaging, and reviewing symptoms and family medical history. Doctors are also administer cognitive tests, such as asking people to remember a list of words, draw a clock, or name any animals as they can. What's missing from the evaluation is direct and conclusive biological evidence of Alzheimer's, meaning that the diagnosis relies heavily on the doctor's expertise, says Dr. Rabovinici. Dr. Weaver agrees. It's not like rheumatoid arthritis, for which we can do a blood test, or pneumonia, where you can get an x-ray and go, yep, you've got it. That's important, because according to a 2012 study, about 30% of people clinically diagnosed with Alzheimer's were discovered through autopsy to have not actually had it. That study looked at people with mild to moderate dementia. But to those with only mild cognitive impairment, which is harder to diagnose, the accuracy would be even lower, says Dr. Rabinovici. In some cases, That would mean instead of having Alzheimer's disease, people might have vascular or Lewy body dementia. However, for others, their symptoms are caused by something reversible, such as sleep disorders like sleep apnea, mood disorders like depression, or hormonal changes. Medications such as those used to treat insomnia, incontinence, and even allergies can negatively affect cognitive function, especially in older adults. With new Alzheimer's drugs now available, it's even more important that doctors have the right diagnosis before they prescribe anything. An accurate diagnosis allows people to make crucial decisions, such as whether to quit their jobs or move into assisted living, and allows their families to plan for caregiving support. Michelle Mielke, chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Prevention at Wake Forest University School of Medicine in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, we know where that is, says an earlier and more accurate diagnosis, which a blood test may provide, could transform health care in the future. Plaques start developing in the brain about 20 years before symptoms begin, she explains, and not everyone with plaques will develop a cognitive impairment. She says that for years now, just like we screen people for their cholesterol because we know it is a risk factor for heart attack and stroke, we might be able to screen people by a certain age for amyloid and tau brain proteins. And if they are elevated, we can try a treatment plan of medications that will delay or prevent that person from ever developing symptoms. Finally, a focus on caregivers. Caring for a family member with dementia can be incredibly stressful, but for a long time, caregiver needs have been overlooked. Now that their struggles are better known, thanks to research findings, a review published in the Diagnosis of Clinical Neuroscience in 2022 found that in developed countries, up to 85% of caregivers developed depression and up to 45% developed anxiety. At the same time, however, community support is growing. Initiatives include memory cafes where caregivers can go with their loved ones who has dementia to have coffee, share in activities, find community, and just feel normal for a while. There are more than 700 memory cafes in the U.S. Your local Alzheimer's organization can help you to find one near you. Visit ALZ.org and click the Local Resources tab. Other public places, such as museums, are getting on board running dementia-friendly days where people with cognitive issues and their caregivers are welcome. Phoenix, Arizona is one of the largest dozens of cities that have become dementia-friendly, and under the Dementia-Friendly America initiative from U.S. Aging. The city has expanded its number of memory cafes and runs Dementia Friends presentations that educate people about the condition and how to help those who have it. In addition, the Phoenix Airport offers compassion cacti lanyards printed with green cactuses to people who have dementia and other invisible disabilities, which indicate passengers who may need more help. Abroad, Wembley in London will become the UK's first dementia-friendly national stadium. The goal is to improve the match day experience for people living with dementia, who can find sporting venues disorienting and overwhelming. Paula Spencer, the Fort Collins, Colorado, author of Surviving Alzheimer's, Practical Tips and Soul-Saving Wisdom for Caregivers, knows firsthand how hard caregiving is. She cared for her father-in-law who had dementia. "Truly the most intense emotions I've ever experienced have been from being a live-in caregiver," she says. As a coping mechanism, she and her husband used to say to each other, "It's not him, it's the dementia." "Intellectually, you know that," she says, "but emotionally you can just be so frustrated and almost angry with the person, and then you feel guilty." Though it's not a full solution, there's now a push for caregivers' work to be financially supported. Many states now allow children, grandchildren, and even friends to be paid for caregiving through Medicaid, and more are allowing spouses to be paid as well. It's been a breakthrough for caregivers that there's an increasing emphasis on their emotional and mental health, says Scott. Over the last 10 to 15 years, there's been a huge groundswell of support. This also helps reduce the stigma around people with dementia, says Dr. Gibbs. "I'm very upfront with telling people about my Alzheimer's. A couple of weeks ago, my wife and I went to our 50th college reunion, and I talked to my classmates about it. Sometimes I think we're too hesitant to engage people with dementia." More clarity in the clauses. Over the past two decades, there has been a myopic focus on amyloid plaques, says Dr. Weaver. His lab is researching another factor, inflammation. "I think of Alzheimer's as an autoimmune disease of the brain, where the immune system is turned on by multiple factors like air pollution, depression, or infections," he says. "Now you have a hopped-up immune system on a search-and-destroy mission in the brain, It's wandering around inside your skull, and oops, it searches for and destroys a few neurons, which cause inflammation. Other researchers, too, are looking at different directions, he says. Malfunction of the brain's mitochondria, which produces energy for the cells, lipids in the brain becoming distorted, or diseased membranes, damage to which could kill the cell. Treatments being tested for other possible dementia causes include stem cell therapy and transcranial magnetic stimulation. Dr. Weaver says he will always remember one of the first encounters with a dementia patient, a military veteran. The poor man was so confused that he was hiding under his hospital bed, Dr. Weaver recalls. He was living his war experiences. I got down on my hands and knees and looked into the man's eyes. It was heartbreaking. I thought, we've got to do something for these people. After the frustrating decades since then of delivering the news to thousands of patients that they have dementia, he's more determined than ever to finally be able to tell them, I have something that can help you. Now, here's something I'm going to start reading that I never have in the past, and I really probably should have. Nowadays, that so many books are able to get them audio in form of audiobooks or online, or even get them in large print online. So I'm going to they have reviewed three books here, and I'd like to let them in. From the future, we'll go ahead and do this every month. The Football 100. The Football 100 by Mike Sando, Dan Pompey, and the Athletic NFL staff. In its storied history, the NFL has seen more than 27,000 athletes take the field. Now sports news service, The Athletic, both asks and answers, who is the greatest of all time? Stats don't paint the full picture. The game that quarterback Patrick Mahomes plays today barely resembles the one dominated by Otto Graham 70 years ago. Going beyond box scores with hundreds of interviews, the Football 100 is a ranking of NFL greats. With all the research and experience brought by the Athletic staff, fans can't possibly argue their favorite players' rankings, right? I bet. Holly by Stephen King. Ooh. Quiet, capable sleuth Holly Gibney entered the Stephen King multiverse in 2014's Mr. Mercedes and already stands out among decades of iconic characters. In her standalone novel, Gibney is no longer under the wing of Mr. Mercedes protagonist Bill Hodges. And while the kids in it had Pennywise the Clown, Gibney has Professors Rodney and Emily Harris, elderly, semi-retired academics who are far from fitting the profile of kidnappers of the missing girl Gibney is trying to find. But the Harrises prove as monstrous as any King boogeyman. Gibney proves as dynamic and enduring. America Fantastica. Tim O'Brien. Author Tim O'Brien's first novel in 20 years turns a good old-fashioned heist story on its head. The armed bank robbery executed by Boyd Havelson is the least exciting thing about the book, and by the page 6, the job is already done. The excitement is in the runaway, but from what exactly is unclear. A variety of pursuers are on Halverson's trail, but never police. Alongside Halverson for the cross-country escape is Angie Bink, a chatty bank teller kidnapped during the stick-up. Halverson and Bing press forward as the novel moves backward to unravel Halverson's true motive, which has little to do with the loot. How about some holiday miracles? Magic tales of Christmas cheer shared and received. And let's start off with The Cat Who Came Home for Christmas and the Making of a Believer. It was Christmas Eve morning, and I woke with a mission to find my lost cat, Baby Girl. As I got ready, I could hear icy rain pelting down the windows. I said a quick prayer for Baby Girl. She was out there somewhere in the storm, and I could just feel it. Sure, it had been 6 months since she'd gone missing, but I still had faith. It was the season for miracles, after all. That summer, my sweet kitty had disappeared from my parents' house in Indiana. Baby Girl had been staying with them while I was between apartments. At the time, I lived and worked in Washington, D.C., and I was staying with friends until I signed my lease on a new place. Baby Girl had gotten out of my parents' house 3 days before I was set to fly back home to pick her up. My dad and I spent the entire visit searching for her. Dad was the family resident realist, which meant she spent a whole lot of time trying to prepare me for the worst. She's either been hit by a car or been taken by someone who found her, he said. I rolled my eyes. Dad had always supported me, but he was so skeptical. He could do with a little more faith. Besides, though I couldn't explain it, I knew I'd see Baby Girl again. She'd been astray when I found her, a scrappy little tabby that had survived all on her own. If any cat could do the impossible, it was Baby Girl. Even after I returned to D.C. without her, and for weeks stretched into months, deep down I had this feeling that we'd be reunited. Now, home again for the holidays, I was determined to pick up my search. I grabbed Baby Girl's cat carrier and loaded it into the car, and then asked my dad to drive me to the shelter, hoping she'd been found. "Sharon, you have to be realistic," my dad said as we headed to the garage. "She's been gone too long. You're not going to find her." "Well, I just have a feeling," I said. Dad raised an eyebrow as he climbed into the driver's seat. "Don't you believe in Christmas miracles?" I asked. "Bah, humbug," he said, lightening the mood. It was his favorite Christmas saying and an inside joke in our family. He even had a shirt with the phrase emblazoned across the front, which he wore every Christmas morning. I threw my hands up in mock despair. At the shelter, the woman at the front door greeted my family warmly. "Good to see you again, Mr. Dillon. Still looking for your cat?" "Ah," I thought, "maybe he's not such a pessimist after all." A staff member took us to see the cats. "When did she go missing?" the woman asked. 6 months ago." "And was she chipped?" No, I had to admit, Baby Girl was not. The staffer notably winced at the words. "When we get unchipped cats, they're put up for adoption after 3 days," she explained. "Even if your cat was brought in, she's probably gone by now." I walked through the rows of cages. My eyes scanned cats of all shapes and sizes. None of them was my Baby Girl. Then I noticed a room farther back. I pushed ahead. "Sweetheart, that's where they keep the cats that just came in," Dad said. "Your cat wouldn't be in there." "It doesn't hurt to look, I said. I hepped into the room and heard a familiar meow. My eyes zeroed in on a little tabby cat with big green eyes. She was skinnier than I remembered, but was Baby Girl all right? My eyes welled up with tears. I opened the cage door, and Baby Girl practically jumped into my arms. I held her close as Dad looked on, mouth agape. "Dad, it's Baby Girl," I cried. "There's just no way," he mumbled to himself. I returned to the front desk to let them know I'd found my cat. The shelter staff was skeptical. I pointed out that this cat matched Baby Girl's description perfectly, right down to her left white paw. Still, they looked uncertain. "Wait here. I can prove she's my cat," I said, excusing myself to grab the carrier. I trained Baby Girl to walk inside the carrier when I opened its door. Sure enough, when she was let down in the middle of the room, she made a beeline for the carrier and scooted right inside. "That's definitely your cat," the staffer said, laughing. "I've never seen any cat do that willingly." I asked when she'd been brought in. She'd arrived during the ice storm, likely about the same time I'd prayed. Back home, the rest of the family welcomed Baby Girl. She purred like a motorboat, rubbing up against everyone's legs. She seemed completely at home. Dad remained stubbornly skeptical. "It just cannot be her," he said. "Not after all this time." I rolled my eyes. Eventually, Baby Girl made her way down to the basement where a litter box was kept. "See? How would you know that the box was there if she hadn't been here before?" I said to Dad. "Fine," he said. "I'm 40% convinced it's her." "What would it take to change her mind?" I asked. He considered for a moment. "If she sits in her favorite spot on the hearth, I'll believe it's her." Baby Girl loved to sit curled up inside my parents' decorative fireplace. And that's exactly what she did as soon as dinner was done. "Okay, maybe it's her," Dad admitted. "I'm about 60% sure." We all groaned. Dad took his armchair to read as we wound down for the evening. All of a sudden, he burst out laughing. "What's so funny, Bill?" Mom asked. "My book," he said. "It says, Baby Girl, I have lost you. Now I have found you. I will never lose you again." We all roared with laughter. "Is that enough, Dad, or does the Holy Spirit himself have to appear and tell you?" I asked. "Okay, 90%, Dad said, but only because the Baby Girl in the story is a lost dog, not a cat." We were almost in tears from laughing so hard. My heart was filled with gratitude, and I was surrounded by family, and against all odds, my cat was home again, 6 months after going missing. It turned out Baby Girl's return wasn't the only Christmas miracle that year. The next day, when Dad came downstairs for Christmas morning, he was wearing a new holiday shirt. It read, "I Believe." And with that, let's switch over to the Consumer Reports. And considering the time of year we're in, this is probably an extremely important thing to have. 9 secrets to getting great customer service. How to reach a rep by phone and have your problem solved. Stat. After asking his satellite company to change his TV service from wired to wireless, Scott and Brotsman spent months trying to get the job done. First, technicians failed to show up for scheduled appointments. Then, when one finally did, work wasn't done correctly and caused even more problems. Brotsman eventually decided to take his business elsewhere, but had to spend more time getting a refund for services he'd already paid for. He estimated the whole ordeal took more than 20 hours, and that's not counting all the time he spent getting up to change TV channels because his remote wouldn't work. Oh, that's so terrible for us who are older. Don't you remember not having a remote? It was the most horrific customer care experience I've ever endured, says Brotsman, who as president and CEO of Customer Care Measurement and Consulting in Alexandria, Virginia, knows a thing or two about how it's supposed to work. In fact, the money involved was negligible. For me, it was more a matter of principle. Chances are, Brotsman experience sounds familiar. More than 60% of people report feeling angry when they run into a problem with a product or service, and about two-thirds aren't satisfied with actions the company take to resolve their issues. According to the 2023 National Consumer Rage Survey, which Brotsman Company conducts every few years, blame automated call systems, hard-to-navigate automated phone trees, understaffed call centers, and FAQs that don't answer our cues. It often feels as if companies are less generous and less concerned than ever about making their customers happy. It's not surprising, then, that consumers have become increasingly ticked off about their problems and are showing it. More than 40% of people in the Consumer Rage Survey said they yelled at or raised their voice to a customer service rep, while only 35% admitted doing it so in 2015. If your last interaction with the customer service department left you wishing that you had still had a phone you could slam down in frustration, take a deep breath. There are a few new tricks to getting what you want from a service rep with less stress, and they involve knowing best way to reach out. Should you use chatbot, email, or phone call? And then what to say once you connect with one. Number one, check service ratings before you buy. The first and best way to reduce your chances of having a poor customer experience? Whenever possible, get products and/or services from companies that have a reputation for taking good care of their clients. Shep Hyken, that's an interesting name, H-Y-K-E-N, a customer service expert and consultant in St. Louis, who has written several books on the subject, does an annual survey that asks consumers which companies deliver the most satisfying customer service experiences. For 2023, his services found that the top six are Amazon, Walmart, Target, Apple, Chick-fil-A, and Costco. Consumer Reports also includes customer service experiences in the overall satisfaction rating for things like appliances, mattresses, luggage, and eyeglass retailers, as well as for tire stores, insurers, and cell phone service and telecom providers. So be sure to check out our ratings for those products and services when you're deciding whom to give your business to. Looking for intel on a provider in a different category or for a local shop? Do a quick search on social media. Nearly a third of all complaints in the Consumer Rage Survey posted about their most serious problems on Facebook, Instagram, X, formerly known as Twitter, or elsewhere. Most companies get at least one or two complaints from customers, but if you see many of them to detect a pattern of dissatisfaction, those could be red flags and a good reason to make your purchase elsewhere. Also, pay attention to the dates of reviews because a company's approach to customer service may change over time, so older reviews may have less relevance. Number two, try self-help. Depending on your problem, you may have to contact customer service. You may not have to contact customer service at all. The websites of many companies have information about their policies for returns, exchanges, and refunds, with instructions on how to start the process. More complicated questions can sometimes be resolved by using Google or YouTube. For example, if you're having internet troubles, before getting into the cable provider's phone queue, try typing "My internet connection is slow" into the search bar. You might find articles and videos that you can follow to troubleshoot and potentially solve the problem by yourself. Number three, use a chatbot. The next easiest and fastest solution is using the chat feature of the company if it has one on its website. If it does, you'll probably see a pop-up alerting you. Again, this is often the best for simple problems and common questions, because you're usually going to talking to a robot programmed to help solve a limited number of issues. but a shortcoming of chatbots, according to Digital Genius, a company that designs products that provide customer service using artificial intelligence, is that many of them can't take action for you. They can, however, get you answers to questions. They're programmed to answer with almost no wait time, and sometimes patch you through to a human agent. Number 4, make a phone call to get a rep. One of the top customer service complaints in the Consumer Rage Survey was about how some companies deliberately make it difficult for customers to figure out how to contact them. Oh, tell me about that. And when you do find a number, you'll be forced to navigate an aggravating phone tree system to get to the department you want. Save yourself some trouble by typing the company's name into the search box at gethuman.com. That's at gethuman.com, which offers customer service phone numbers for more than 1,000 companies and where they have a callback system, along with phone tree hacks. Typing company name customer service into Google can also help you get the right number. Another fast way to reach a rep in most cases, if you keep saying representative or pressing zero long enough, you'll probably finally get to a human being, because that can bypass the automated system, says Edgar Jaworski, a former assistant attorney general in Massachusetts who now runs ConsumerWorld.org, an online consumers' resource guide. If you can, avoid making customer service calls on Monday morning. That's when everyone who's been stewing over an issue all weekend calls in, jamming phone lines and overwhelming representatives. Call centers tend to be easier to get through on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday afternoon, says Brad Cleveland, author of Leading the Customer Experience, How to Chart a Course and Deliver Outstanding Results. The effort may be worth it. According to a Consumer Reports nationally representative survey in August of 2,062 U.S. adults, about half said that talking to a person worked better in all customer service situations than using an automated system like chatbots. Number 5. State your case calmly. When you get someone on the phone, remember that being huffy and argumentative and demanding is a mistake, Jaworski says. These people are human beings, and when you're yelling, you're not going to be predisposed to give you anything you want. Instead, clearly outline your problem in a calm and friendly way, and let the service rep know you'd like to resolve it. Be persistent about stating what you want, Brotsman says. If you're looking for a free replacement part, waived fees, or a partial or full refund, ask for it. And repeating the request over and over can help the service rep get on the same page as you. Cleveland agrees. Listen to a customer service representative's solution, as they often have guidelines they must follow, he says. But if their initial offer doesn't strike you as fair or good enough, continue to push and try to negotiate a more satisfactory solution, he advises. Speak to someone else. By the way, I actually have tried that. We had an outage in our cable service here in Durham, North Carolina, where I live. And the standard was put out that if you called in and requested a refund, you would get a refund. Well, because I didn't call in during the set period of time, I was not entitled to that particular refund. But they actually had a bonus program. They could kick back money into my account. So my next bill was $20 less than it would have been had I not called in. Number 6, speak to someone else. If you strongly believe that you deserve what you're asking for and the customer service rep isn't being helpful enough, thank the person, hang up, and call back, Hyken says. A different agent might see things differently. I'm amazed at how often I call a company and talk to two or more people, getting a different answer each time. You can also ask to speak to a supervisor. That person may have more leeway to help you. Number 7, consider raising the stakes. Your next stick depends on the kind of company you're dealing with. If you're complaining to a neighborhood store or small business, such as home or auto repair shop, that has a local reputation to protect, making a gentle threat, such as saying you're going to complain to the Better Business Bureau, or post about your ordeal on social media, or simply tell all your friends about it, will probably carry some weight, Brotsman says. Bigger companies may not be as sensitive to those kind of ultimatums, but if you have an ongoing relationship with the company, as you likely do, say with your cable or cell phone provider, ask to speak to someone in what's called the customer retention department. That person is incentivized to try to have you not leave in a huff, Brossman says, so you might have more success. Number 8, complain publicly. If all of your efforts have still netted you nothing, sometimes going on a social media channel to broadcast your complaint can be effective. Just be sure to use the Amsperand symbol before the company name. Doing this is better than writing a letter to the CEO of the company, Brotsman says, because at many companies, the resources once allocated to reading paper correspondence are now put into social media monitoring duty. Some companies may be inclined to respond to public criticism if they think their reputation is on the line. Be brief and to the point. You can say something like, XYZ company promised next day delivery, then delayed my package by a week, now refusing to refund overnight shipping cost. Won't shop there again. You might find a response from the company asking you to direct message to it and some info so it can solve the problem. Number 9, take the post service survey. Not only will this provide feedback for the company, potentially improve their customer service policies in the future, it might also result in an additional response from the company. That was the case for Jorski when he filled out a survey from a home maintenance company in which he let it know that he thought the tech did only a superficial job on an HVAC tune-up. After receiving his response, the company called Jorski to ask if he wanted the senior tech to come out to do a more thorough inspection. Sometimes filling out an evaluation can lead to the company wanting to make a poor experience right, he says. Getting service reps to listen. For the best results when dealing with customer service, you want to get the rep to see your point of view. The approach should be that the representative is your partner in crime, and you're trying to collaborate with that person, says Andrea Lehrers, managing partner at the Shapiro Negotiation Institute in Baltimore. You're not negotiating against them, you're negotiating with them. At right are phrases he suggests you use, which we're going to read, obviously. Have you ever been able to help another customer who had the same problem? Can you tell me more about that and what you were able to do? This phrasing gives the customer service representative a chance to consider a solution that may have worked for other customers in the past. Their answer might prompt you to share additional details about your situation that could be relevant or inspire new and more favorable ideas for resolution. Put yourself in my shoes. Seeking a connection creates empathy. Helping a customer service rep understand where you're coming from. When the host of a rental home that Larez had reserved for his family canceled the booking a day before the vacation, the rental company's service rep told Larez to rebook elsewhere. But the options were more expensive and less desirable. Connect with the agent, Larez asked her if she had children and how she would explain the step-down in vacation rental to them if she were in his position. That changed the tenor of the conversation, Larez said. Okay, we can try everything for your family. Ultimately, they found an acceptable house and got a 20% refund worth hundreds of dollars. I really appreciate that you're trying your best, but the solutions you've outlined so far don't work for me. I'd like to talk to a supervisor, please. This acknowledges the effort and work the customer service representative already did, without belittling them personally. That way, they're more likely to quickly escalate your request, and to potentially do so on a positive note rather than putting you on hold while they brief their manager about what a difficult customer you are. A Consumer Reports Secret Shopper's Advice for Better Service. Consumer Reports employs 3 full-time secret shoppers, including John, not his real name, of course, who buys most of the products we test, including appliances, tech products, and mattresses. John has been shopping for CR for 30 years. He regularly deals with service reps when there are delivery problems or when products arrive with broken or missing parts. Here are his tips for getting the best customer service. Do. Get prepped. Before you contact customer service, gather the necessary paperwork. You'll probably need your order number, account number, the date the transaction took place, and perhaps the warranty. In the case of appliances, you also need the serial number. Don't. Show up at a store right before closing needing help. You'll typically get the best in-person customer service if you arrive just after the store opens. I will only go to Walmart before 10 a.m. if I need help with something, John says. Later in the day, it's just like a zoo. Don't throw out the packaging. Some stores won't take back items unless you have all of the original packaging material, so keep them on hand for as long as possible. Do start the process immediately for large appliances and electronics. For some large appliances and electronics, you need to contact the company within 48 hours or they won't take the item back. That's the policy at Lowe's, for example, for major appliances like refrigerators, rangers, and washing machines. Do. Go to stores where you know you'll get great customer service. John routinely drives to a Best Buy that's in another town because it has better customer service than the one closer to him. Do shop local when possible. Smaller shops often have better customer service than national chains, John says. That's because the owners may have more flexibility to bend the return policy or make other arrangements to help. John especially prefers small stores for large appliances because he can go back to them and speak to a person instead of getting stuck in a phone loop. And do use the Amazon chatbots. For most problems with Amazon orders, you can get a fast fix through the online portal without ever speaking to a person. I'll agree with that. I've used that. Often they'll tell you to keep the items and refund you or send you a new one, John says. Now that we're into the, working into the holiday season, this is kind of important. The safer way to drink. If you're a drinker, this is very important. One minute there are studies that say alcohol is good for you, and others say it's bad. What's the truth? We've got it here along with the best and, yes, healthier ways to drink wine, beer, and cocktails. Tis the season to lift a glass, whether it's a Beaujolais with Thanksgiving turkey, eggnog at a holiday party, or a flute of bubbly for a New Year's toast. Enjoying an alcoholic drink is an important part of the festive season for many of us. And for the rest of the year, studies going back decades have suggested that a nightly glass of red wine or other alcoholic beverage is healthy and contributes to a longer life. Was that right? Well, not exactly. New research has put a damper on some of the fun, reconsidering those alleged benefits and highlighting some risk. Most notably, a widely reported review published last spring in the journal JAMA Open Network, which looked at the health and drinking habits of almost 5 million people, concluded that imbibing small amounts of alcohol does not lengthen your life. In January, the World Health Organization declared that when it comes to alcohol consumption, there is no safe amount that does not affect health. Why? After years of saying a drink a day is good for you, are experts now saying sort of the opposite? We're going to explain all that below, but here's some reassurance. While even moderate drinkers may benefit from cutting back, if you've been following the current guidelines, no more than one drink a day for women and no more than two for men, your risk of adverse health effects may be small depending on your health situation. Most important, if you want to drink less alcohol, we have some smart strategies that will help you cut back and to help make that effort more pleasurable. We have a look at the burgeoning de-alcoholized wine trend, along with some tests of some tasty no-alcoholic bubbles to enjoy during the holidays or at any time. The new mantra, less is more. We've long been told that a little bit of alcohol is beneficial, perhaps because of the antioxidants in red wine or the B vitamins in beer. Not surprisingly, about half of Americans got the memo, believing that a drink or two a day is good for our health, at least not harmful, according to a national representative survey of 2,062 adults, that must be their favorite number, conducted in August of 2023. But alcohol researchers and public health experts say those perceptions should change, says Tim Niami, MD, director of the University of Victoria's Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research in British Columbia, and an author of the recent JAMA Open Network study. The latest thinking, he says, is that when it comes to alcohol, less is more. That's because Niami and other researchers have pinpointed problems with the way much of the previous research was conducted. Specifically, many of the studies from that suggested possible health benefits from alcohol compared moderate drinkers with people who abstained completely. But researchers say now those findings were biased because most, about 90% of the studies looked at in the JAMA Open Network analysis, didn't consider why abstainers didn't drink alcohol or when they stopped drinking. In fact, many people gave up alcohol precisely because they developed health problems. Researchers call them sick quitters. In the JAMA Open Network analysis, once the researchers compared only lifetime non-drinkers with moderate drinkers, and it became clear there was no health benefits to consuming any amount of alcohol. Actually, the risk of dying prematurely was 21% greater for women who had just under two drinks a day and 15% greater for men who had around three drinks a day. Tim Stockwell, Ph.D., a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Victoria, who was also involved in the JAMA Open Network study, says other research now suggests that the risk of mortality increases the moment you start drinking. Or, if you look at it another way, on average, people who have one drink a day lose about 5 minutes a day or a total of about 3 months over a lifetime, Stockwell says. The trouble with alcohol. Other research shows that even in moderate amounts, alcohol increases the risk of several chronic diseases, including heart disease. some cancers, and possibly dementia. For example, a 2023 analysis of studies in the Journal of Hypertension linked drinking any amount of alcohol to rising blood pressure levels over a five-year period, even in people who had normal blood pressure. That added weight up to an earlier analysis of The Lancet, which looked at data from 83 studies and found that people who drank more than 5 to 6 glasses of wine or pints of beer per week had an increased risk of stroke, heart disease, heart failure, and other risk forms of cardiovascular disease. The growing concerns prompted the World Heart Federation to issue a report that stated that the belief that alcohol is good for cardiovascular health is no longer acceptable. As for cancer, research shows that the body breaks down alcohol into a chemical called acetaldehyde, which damages DNA, said Marissa Esser, Ph.D., head of the alcohol program in the National Center for Chronic Disease Prevention and Health Promotion at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That chemical also prevents your body from repairing the damage, and the cells that then can begin growing out of control and creating a cancerous tumor, she says. It might not take much alcohol to increase the odds of developing cancer. Low amounts of alcohol, as little as one drink a day, have been linked to oropharyngeal, esophageal, and female breast cancers. For example, research suggests that light to moderate drinking raises breast cancer risks from 5 to 10%. And according to a report from the World Health Organization, about 6% of the breast cancer cases diagnosed in the U.S. in 2020 were linked to alcohol. The research on dementia and alcohol consumption is less clear-cut, but still concerning. The connection is very obvious among heavy drinkers. A 2018 French study found more than 300% increased risk of dementia among men and women with alcohol use disorders. Other researchers have detected changes in the structure of the brain that are associated with dementia in heavy consumers of alcohol. It's interesting, we just read that other article on dementia. While the research among moderate drinkers is more uncertain, with some evidence showing no or only small increased risk, and possibly even some benefits, Stockwell at the University of Victoria says caution is still warranted. Ethanol in the bloodstream and its metabolite acetaldehyde damages human tissue, he says, and the brain is not protected from those effects. Assessing your risk. When it comes to activities that people enjoy, like drinking alcohol, people are prepared to take more risks, Stockwell says. And the University of Victoria's Naimi adds that he doesn't say everyone should go down to 2 drinks a week, because we know that's not practical or even possible. It's pretty clear from the evidence that if you think you're drinking for your health, you're probably misguided, Stockwell says. But if you're not interested in becoming a teetotaler, here are a few things to consider when deciding how much alcohol is okay for you. Your age. The body's ability to tolerate alcohol decreases as we age. That is partly because lean body tissue, such as muscles and organs, absorb alcohol that fat does not, and the amount of fat rises with age while the amount of lean tissue decreases. As a result, it takes less alcohol to affect our coordination, thinking, and behavior as we get older, making accidents more common. For example, alcohol can alter an older person's sense of balance, leading to falls and fractures or worse. Drinking is a factor in 65% of fatal falls. Your gender. Women want to be more conservative drinkers than men because they are more prone to the immediate and long-term harmful effects of alcohol. Your family medical history, conditions, and prescription drugs. If alcohol abuse, heart disease, or cancer runs in your family, you want to be extra conscious with how much you drink. If you already have high blood pressure, diabetes, or other chronic illness, drinking could make it more difficult to manage your condition and may interact with over-the-counter drugs you take or medications you've been prescribed. Taking aspirin and drinking, for example, can increase the risk of stomach or intestinal bleeding. And high doses of acetaminophen, Tylenol, with alcohol can cause liver damage. Combining alcohol with cold or allergy medications that contain antihistamines can make you very sleepy, and medicines that have high alcohol content, such as laxative and cough syrups, add to the alcohol's effects. And using alcohol while you're on certain sleeping pills, pain pills, or medicine for anxiety or depression can be very dangerous. So check with your pharmacist or physician to see whether a particular condition or drugs makes alcohol off limits. Lots of people, about a third according to CR survey, think there's no difference health-wise between having 3 drinks one day and having 1 drink on 3 different days. But the more alcohol the body has to process at one time, the greater effect on the liver, heart, and other organs. For any amount of alcohol, it's better to spread it out, Naimi says. So Sunday through Thursday are dry days for you, It's not okay to have 4 drinks on Friday and 6 on Saturday. In fact, that describes binge drinking, a type of excessive drinking that's not just for college kids anymore. It's on the rise among older adults and women, statistics show. Why you drink? If you tend to drink out of habit because others around you do, because a party or dinner doesn't seem special without alcohol, ask yourself why you feel that way and become more aware of the way the alcohol plays in your life. It can help you make a more conscious decision about when to drink. And that way, when you do, you might find that you consume less but enjoy it more. Well, we're about out of time, so next week we'll look at what experts mean by one drink, how drinking affects women, how to drink in a healthier way, and the best booze-free sparkling wines. How about a little life in these United States to bring us to a close today? During a church service, a woman announced she would be singing the 22nd Psalm. What followed was a lovely and moving performance. Everyone agreed, everyone except for my 7-year-old son, who whispered, "That song was way longer than 20 seconds." I rushed into the urgent care center, blood pouring from my finger after nicking it while cutting an avocado. The receptionist was clearly an old pro at this. She took one look at my wound and asked, "Avocado or bagel?" How typical. We've entered the time of a year when I can't go to the kitchen to get something to eat without my wife yelling, "Those are for Christmas!" So I guess I'll starve for the next 3 days. My husband and I were many hours into a road trip when I asked him to pull over soon so I could use a restroom. He nodded and drove on passing potential pit stops at gas stations and fast food joints. After half an hour, I said with urgency, "I really have to go." Looking puzzled, he asked, "Still?" As my wife began reading the third entry from her list of resolutions that the grim reality struck, they were resolutions for me. Every Christmas in my hometown, Greeley Ford Norfair, vandals or glass domes are set at the graves in the year cemetery. One year, my brother Gear was looking down at the cemetery from atop a hill when some German tourist stopped to look at too. "What are the lights for?" one asked. Gear replied, "They like to read in bed." I was driving with my godchild, the first grader, when we passed a school. "That school looks hard," he says. "Why do you say that?" I ask. "Look at how big the swings are." And with that, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thanks so very much for listening.